us now begin with the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Okay, may we have roll call, please?
Good evening, Commissioners. I'll take the roll call. Chair Hartwig?
Present.
Vice Chair Hurd?
Present.
Janet Castillo is excused. Commissioner Main?
Present.
Commissioner Montgomery?
Present.
Commissioner Pitts?
Present.
Commissioner Jung Lee?
Present.
Thank you.
Do we have a motion to approve the previous month's minutes?
So moved.
Oh, so moved.
I'll second.
Seconded. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All those, any abstentions? Nays? Okay, carries unanimously. Good. Old or unfinished business? There is none. Are there any modifications to the agenda? Okay, hearing none, let us move on to new business, item A.
Good evening, Commissioners. Item A. Item A are three items, and we've got short presentations on them, and they actually have to do with three awards of merit that we're going to present tonight that were awarded by NARO for three different of our programs, and we thought we'd give you a presentation. I have an announcement at the end that I'd like to make. So we're going to go in a very specific order, and I first want to invite Annika Danovskaya to come on up, and she's going to give you a presentation of one of our awards of merit, which is the Community Health Education Screenings Project.
Good evening, Commissioners. So before I talk about the program, I actually want to recognize the effort of one of my staff members that actually initiated the program. She reached the Samuel Mayer University, had several meetings with them, and thought that the program would be beneficial for our community. Her name is Jamie Manilan. She's a resident service coordinator, and without her, this program would not be a success. I think some of you know her because she is a resident service coordinator at Palo Vista Gardens. So we decided to begin the program at Palo Vista. Why did we pick Palo Vista? It's one of our most engaging communities. About 86% of Palo Vista residents are at 30% or below 30% of annual median income, and over 50% of them are disabled seniors. We also pick Lockwood Gardens. Lockwood Garden residents are primarily consisting from the single female households. There's actually 72, I believe, percent at the time when the program took place of the household that consists of single females with kids. And while participation at Palo Vista was excellent, over 50% of the residents participated, the multi-family side, such as Lockwood and later on Campbell Garden, presented a little bit of a challenge. And so what our staff had did, they decided to entice the participation by offering free Zumba and yoga classes, offering health services at the days when we had the food pantry distribution. What did the program consist of? The program consists of 15 weeks presence of the nursing students at the site. They come every week. They do health screening, measure blood pressure, do health cooking demonstration. They do exercise classes. They do home visits for the people that don't feel like they're able to make it to the community center on that day. For multifamily sites, because participation was really low in the beginning, they did individual home visits. And the program was so successful that after it was implemented at Palo Vista and then at Lockwood, we also expanded the program to Campbell. And then now we're talking about, now we actually had several classes at two senior sites, Oak Grove North and Oak Grove South. And we are talking about expanding the program to Harrison Towers and Adele Courts, the additional two senior sites. The cost of the program is extremely low. The external cost is about $300 per semester, and that just basically supplies for the cooking classes, for the exercise classes. The majority of the cost is in kind, and it's a percentage of the resident service coordinator time from OHA staff, and also a percentage of time for the nursing student coordinator. And what the way this program is different from any other health presentations is our residents get the continuity of service. So they get somebody consistently at the site for 15 weeks. And then when the classes resume in the following semester, they get another 10 or 15 weeks of the same weekly checkup. And I'm here to answer questions.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Andy. Stay up front, yes, if you would. So the next program we wanted to talk a little bit about, our next Award of Merit winner, is our is part of the Brighter Than Blight program. And it was really the OHA part as opposed to the California Affordable Housing Initiatives part, which did the primary sort of weight in getting the project going. But what we did partner with, what they partnered with OHA on, was the Youth Docent Program. And this was the idea of how do you take the art and communicate in a really, make it real for the people who are coming to visit the site. During that period, we had about 1,500 people visit this art project and talk to our youth. And I want to bring Lenita up to give us a brief description. I think we have a PowerPoint for this one. Yeah, that we'll walk through on the program. And it was really a wonderful addition, and I think that it's very much deserves the award.
Good evening, Commissioners. I'm Lenita Ellis, Director of the Family and Community Partnerships Department. I, too, would like to recognize staff from the Family and Community Partnerships Department who did an amazing job in supporting this project. They are Sean Johnson and Petraeo Smith, who are also here this evening. They are resident and community services coordinators who supported with the recruitment, training, and supervision of the resident leaders and the youth who served as docents for the project. And I'm not sure if you're familiar with them, so I'm hoping that they'll stand and maybe give you a wave. What you're seeing on this slide is a photo of the building located at the corner of 77th and Bancroft in East Oakland, which was also known as Greenside. This is a photo of the building before the art installation. The building had been vacant for over 10 years. This photo is the artist's rendering of the vision of the building prior to the installation taking place. He wanted to use an all-black backdrop to serve as a canvas for the art installation in the exhibit. The evening hours and the black backdrop were to serve as allowing the art to pop, if you would, with the exhibits, which was open for 6 days. The art consisted of 8 major installations. The artist used art as a visual teaching tool, and each installment embodied the common thread of resilience through struggle and hope overcoming hopelessness. We recruited youth docents as well as resident leaders who also served as the docent supervisors. They had formal job descriptions, formal job training. They were trained on the artist's vision. They were trained on each installation, rudimentary job skills such as communication, boundaries, how to complete a time card, public speaking, and not only that, through role play, but they were encouraged to express the artist's vision. Many of them surprised that they were also encouraged to express what they thought of the art and encouraging the patrons to express what they thought of the art as well. And I believe this is something that many of the patrons coming to the exhibit were pleasantly surprised at, in how well the young people engaged in them and with them and moved them through the art exhibit. Some challenges that we had in working with the youth and some successes. Most of the youth had absolutely no experience at all with art, very little experience with public speaking. This creating a lot of self-esteem or lack of confidence for them. And the artist, as well as the FCP staff team, working with them through role play, through exercise, through taking them actually to the site to create the training as a way to get them a little more comfortable and more prepared for what they were going to experience. They also knew in advance who was going to be coming. They knew that it was going to be elected officials. They knew that it was going to be people who participated in art. Many of them were very nervous and anxious about being on display themselves, if you would, and being so much at the front of attention. But if everyone who came to the exhibit, I think, would share with you how they were, you wouldn't have known how much the jitters the youth had by the time the exhibit was over. Over the 6 days, 13 youth were employed and earned over $3,000 in wages, not each youth earning that much, but in total. About 25 hours average each youth was able to work, as well as the adult docents as well. Obviously, the youth hours had to be less due to labor law, essentially. Many of the patrons were neighbors and East Oakland residents as well. And if you're wondering where they are now, we've got some playing basketball at McClymonds High School. Some are participating in our Summer Education and Employment Program, which is a partnership that we have with Youth Uprising. Two of them are OHA Explorers. Many of them are attending high school with the Oakland Unified School District. And we've got a few who are looking forward to attending college in the fall of 2015.
There are also, there was a lot of other staff on our side that really helped with this, and I want to kind of recognize that we had innumerable kind of support and help from Patricia Wells and Leanne Farner from the CAHI side, but also Artesia's here, and she was out there many a night helping out, doing the job. Greer was photographing and coordinating the whole thing, and it was a lot of work for everyone. Nicole's back there as well, and all OHAPD police did and worked the community extremely well through the event. It was really a huge effort on behalf of a lot of people who volunteered their time to be out there on the weekend and on the evenings, because that's when this occurred, to make it all happen. And it was, a wonderful event. The last one, we are going to have a presentation from Chief Duplessis on OHAPD's Community Alert Program.
Good evening, Commission. Carol Duplessis, Chief of Police. The Community Alert Program actually started as what we call the Guest Assist Program. From looking around, not necessarily what law enforcement does, but other entities for greater security measures, we found out that the NFL, actually, they started this program at the Glendale Stadium that they built in Arizona by creating a text messaging system within the football stadium. So if while people saw events or they saw various things that they needed to notify the police, that there were signs posted and they would be able to just text the message over to them. Well, we thought about that internally within the housing authority and thought, well, that's a great idea, because what do we see outside of our developments? We see kids with their cell phones as well as adults, and what do? They text message. And we're always looking for better, more creative ideas as far as getting information quicker to the police department and being able to respond more efficiently. So we introduced a guest assist program by posting signs throughout the Lockwood development, and it worked. As people began to see various things, they would text OHAPD. Inside our police communications room dispatch, there was a big screen monitor that it would flash the alert, and they were able to dispatch officers right away to the event. But it took a while for us to realize that we were missing a great component of this program, and that was the ability to be able to talk back. Also, to be able to put information out to the greater community. We thought about other venues, such as, I know a lot of people have heard of Nexel and other types of services where law enforcement agencies are able to provide information such as crime alerts or other avenues of crime prevention to the general public. Through discussions with staff, we realized that was not the best method for us. What we wanted to do and what we needed to was to be able to control the audience and not have information go out to everyone. Well, we didn't realize that the same software we have for Guest Assist actually had that mechanism. So we developed what's called a Community Alert Program, where we're actually able to send messages preemptively. instead of waiting for them to respond back. Such as if there's a burglary that occurs, as soon as we get information from the officers, we will send an email out to the community and tell them that a burglary just occurred at this address. If you have information, please notify us. Ironically, residents really took to this program, and we do get text messages back. In some cases, they actually provide us named suspects for this. But in addition to it, reminders for community meetings. We just recently had our Lockwood Block Party. We'll send an email out to everyone, and we'll tell them that, remember, we're having it. Christmas morning, we'll send an email and wishing everybody a Merry Christmas. And like I said, this program has really, really taken off well. To the point, recently, OPD Chief Wendt asked me about that because he thought it was very innovative, and he thought that was something that OPD actually could use. As far as I know, we are the only agency in the country that actually have this type of service where we're controlling the audience, where we limit it only to the people who sign up. Our staff goes house to house, as well as during the Lockwood meeting, we actually had neighbors who live around Lockwood. We felt it was important enough to include them in the system as well as staff. So as things occur in the development or as things happen, we will send a text email out to everyone. So even if you have a business that's adjacent that might be affected to Lockwood, staff who works there, or even staff who works in other buildings, they'll all get the text message advising them of what occurred. And like I said, very frequently we will receive information back from them, so we are communicating. One of our RAB members actually, who lives in Lockwood, is part of the program, actually was impressed with the program and asked us whether or not we had the ability to send video, whether they could take a picture and send it back to us if they could. And we're working on the system right now to see if we can actually incorporate that. Now, all that, I'll tell you, I want to believe that it was all my idea and it was great, and realistically, I came up with the idea and told my staff, this is what I want. And after they get a hold of it, it never really resembles exactly what my vision was. But I am very, very blessed to have great staff that's able to take these programs on. I want to introduce in the back Luther Dupree. He's our Sergeant of Crime Prevention. And Jackie Mesterhazy. She's our Records Communication Supervisor. And they were instrumental in getting this program up and running to where it is now. And like I said, it doesn't stop there. We're expecting to expand the program in other developments, as well as other parts, and to enhance the program itself to be able to have the best form of communication, lines of communication between our residents, the community, and our officers. Any questions?
How do you sign up?
You just have to contact Jackie Mesterhazy, and she'll put you on the list. As we start adding more sites, it's going to be critical to see which areas you want to sign up to, because what we don't want to do is open it up to everybody. We're not going to blast an email throughout the city. If the message is for the residents of Lockwood, we want it for the residents of Lockwood and not for everybody, because one of the main points of this is not only to advise the residents what's going on in the community, and it's good community partnership and ownership for them to help us police. We can't do it by ourselves. But also to retrieve information back. That's the most important thing that we want, is to keep the open lines of communication.
Okay, thank you.
So Chief, does that mean that each geographic area or each development, if it's big enough, has its own address, so to speak, so the communications would just be with that subset of the total? Is that my understanding that right?
Right now we only have it in Lockwood. And our intent is to put it in some of the other developments. As far as the geographical boundaries for this, we define what the geographical boundaries we want it to be, instead of, as I said, just open it up to everyone. If we define in West Oakland that we want to do Campbell Village and we want to do the 3-block area around it, that's something that we can define ourselves and limited only to those people who are affected by that.
Yeah, I see. So have you considered doing this with any of the scattered sites?
No, not at this time, not until we expand them on the large sites. But clearly, I'll tell you, once we get all the large sites done, if we do all the large sites, that's something that we'll look at, most certainly.
Cool.
Yeah, now it's going to mention the senior sites.
senior sites are very imperative. The problem we find with seniors don't text. They don't text. They can't see the phone, and we actually find that for a lot of the seniors that live in our large developments is they have a very, very difficult time with it. So I don't know how effective that would be.
Certainly it's best suited for the developments where we own the streets and the blocks, and that the residents can be inside their unit, see something, and text and say, I just saw someone running down East Lawn.
Yeah. I'm only 50. I can't even see it. Any more questions?
No. All right, I'm going to give the awards, and we're going to stand here. The one thing I just wanted to let everyone know is these now have been nominated and won awards of merit at a local level. They get nominated for submitted by the regional level to the national level to be considered for Award of Excellence, where they award 24 awards nationally in the categories that are in your memo. This is an administrative category, and the other two are resident services. And I'd like to let you know that the chief has won a National Award of Excellence for administration for this program.
Oh, we won?
We won. And thank you. We have not heard about the other two yet. And I have not heard one way or the other, and they come out in different groups, and administration was released, and I received a letter last week, so I thought it would be an appropriate time to have the three presentations and take the picture. So if I can have both the people who presented and also the staff who helped, come on up, Treya, Sean.
You want to put these signs in my picture?
No, I think just the pictures. And if the commissioners can actually stand up above, we get a really good shot when you're behind here and we're down below you.
All right.
Too short.
Walk away.
All right. And they have to stay 1 year here, and then you can take them and swap them out.
Lenita, can I just close this or lower this?
So the trick is just come around front.
But Greer, aren't you going to be short?
We're going to use this photo. So come around if you'd like.
Let's go down. That way down.
What you want to do is just make sure you can see her leg. You can see her leg. You can see you.
Then where are we? Can
we move up tighter?
Yeah, I think we need, it would be best if Patricia and Chief were
in the middle.
And William. See, I didn't see William.
Okay.
So let's get at least one person on that side. Everybody's smooshed together. And I cannot see Commissioner Montgomery.
You see me?
No, I cannot see you.
And I will let you know when we receive notice on the first two, because that has not come out yet.
Well, on behalf of the commission, we'd like to thank all of you for another example of real splendid work on the part of OHA. And in fact, I went to Brighter Than Blight twice. So I, on two occasions, was able to actually interact with the docents. And that really was... those were an incredible bunch of people, and they were really well trained. But here's the thing, their enthusiasm was so cool. I mean, they were loving what they were doing. And so now we have two other things that have happened that are on a similar level. I mean, we should really all be very, very proud of this. And I'm really glad to see that we're not, you know, sitting on, I mean, we've been winning a lot of awards, but we're not staying still. We're continuing to push forward and keep going for more. So well done. I like the spirit.
Thank you. I also should mention that Councilmember Desley Brooks was really instrumental in making all this happen for us and getting us the okays, and I'm grateful for her and for her efforts on behalf of
Oh, for
of
the
all
brighter
this.
Than blight.
Yeah, for the brighter
yes,
than blight.
Yes, yes.
It was an important help.
Okay, so, so great. So we're now moving on to item B.
Item B is a public hearing on proposed changes to the admissions and continued occupancy policy for public housing program residents. Dominica Henderson is here with a short presentation to march you through the changes that have gone out for public comment. Then we can open and close the public hearing, and the item will come forward for final approval at the next board meeting. Dominica?
Thank you. I'll just give me 1 second.
Okay, let's all note her password as she does this.
Okay, good evening, Commissioners. My name is Dominica Henderson, and I am here to go through with you the changes to the admissions and continued occupancy policy, or what we call the ACOP. Recently, there were some requirements mandated by Congress to change flat rent policies. And so this was a mandate for all public housing authorities across the nation. And so we have to not only change our ACOP, but we also have to change a piece of the lease in order to reflect the updated flat rent rates. And so I'll go through the changes and do a little bit of and show you an impact analysis as well for the current households that are on flat rent. The regulatory and policy requirements that are required as a part of this change, first, it's mandated by the Consolidated Appropriations Bill that was recently adopted in 2014 in January. And so Congress has mandated that all housing authorities, like I said, change their flat rent policies so that they are set at no less than 80% of the fair market rent for the area. And so that's required by the appropriations bill. And in the spring, HUD put out a notice that provided some preliminary guidance on how to implement this new flat rent policy. This only impacts the public housing program, not the voucher program. And so typically, there are residents have an option of selecting an income-based rent or the flat rent. If they are at a level where the flat rent is lower than their tenant portion, then they select the flat rent. In our case, our flat rents are set using different standards that have been approved by federal guidelines, but because this new policy is requiring that instead of taking into consideration neighborhood surrounding neighborhood or the different scenarios that might impact when you're setting a reasonable rent, now HUD has just said across the board, all housing authorities must charge 80% of the fair market rent. So when implementing the notice, we have to change the ACOP, and we also have to update the schedule of rents, which is included with the lease. And so in your packet, you have the tracked changes to the ACOP, which show the language that we changed. And basically what the policy will do is update the flat rents so that they are at 80% of the fair market rent for new admissions and for all households who are currently on income-based rent. So beginning on November 1st, if a household that's on an income-based rent decides they want to select flat rent instead, they would be offered the flat rent at the new rate, at the 80% of the fair market rent. And for all the households that are currently on flat rent, we also included in your packet the track changes that show how that policy will be implemented. Our current flat rents are divided into two unit types. A modernized unit and a non-modernized unit have different flat rents. As you can see, the non-modernized are lower. We typically have, most people are in 2 and 3 bedrooms, and the modernized units are fairly higher. When we have to change to the 80% level, the flat proposed flat rent is what you see below in this green box. And those will be straight across for all households, whether they're modernized units or not. And so this is a reflection of the changes that are required by HUD. And clearly, we would take into consideration the neighborhood location. I think that when we are implementing this new policy, it's for the area. So it also includes, our area includes Fremont. And so I think that that impacts our fair market rent. And I think when we were implementing a policy that was different and lower, it was taking into consideration the age of the unit, what has, you know, any rehab that had been performed in the unit, as well as the location and where which developments they're in. So if we go through the impact analysis, there are currently 44 households that are on flat rent. We have 18 of those households in senior sites, and 26 of those households are in family sites. And we have just provided a breakdown of where those, the type of unit that those households are occupying. So 11 are in one bedrooms that are modernized, 6 in non-modernized, and then we go on to the 4 bedrooms. One household is a 4-bedroom household that recently elected to have flat rent, and so they would be scaled up from where they are. And actually, I just wanted to point out too one quick thing. What we see is that when we implement our policy for the households that are currently on flat rent, it's such a jump, such a dramatic change in the amount of the rent that families will have the option to select the flat rent, but annually the housing authority is required to give a family the choice of going back to income-based rent or selecting the flat rent. And so a number of these families for the first year may select the flat rent, but for flat rent you can select it for 3 years. And so if after year one a family says, okay, the flat rent is higher than my tenant portion, they may go back to income-based rent. So it really will depend. It's a family choice, what's best for the family. But I think that what we see from the numbers is that most of the families will, in the first year, continue to select the flat rent because it's less than the tenant portion. But because we have to scale it up to meet this 80% threshold, then they probably will go back to income-based rent within that next 3 years. So we have a couple of ways that we can mitigate that the shift to the higher rents. For the households that are not currently on income-based rent, or for those households that are new admissions, they will be offered the flat rent from day one. So they won't have necessarily this phased option. But for the people who are currently on flat rent, we've proposed to phase in this increase as opposed to just initiating the increase on November 1st. So, for instance, you will see a family who's in a modernized unit, zero to three bedrooms. In the first year, their rent will be increased by 10%. In the second year, their rent would increase again by 10%. And the third year, their rent would increase up to the 35% in order to meet that minimum threshold that HUD has required, but phase in these large increases that could be dramatic and financially burdensome for a lot of the families. And so what we did was included this phased-in percentage also in the ACOP, just so that it was clear that all of the households that are currently on flat rent will have this option as well. So in addition to the phased implementation, we also, like I said, have to offer the annual rent option every year. So a family, like I said, after year one may decide that it's better for them to go back to income-based rent, and they have that option to make that change or to stay on flat rent if they choose. Additionally, a family can at any point request a review and request to change if there's financial hardship. So if a family selects flat rent today, but in 3 months from now just cannot manage that flat rent level, then they do have the option to request a financial hardship, and that interim will be performed. And finally, there is an option as well to create an MTW waiver that would basically allow the Oakland Housing Authority to be able to modify this policy in order to better meet the needs of its residents. There are a few housing authorities that are exempt from this policy, and those housing authorities are the ones that have already established flat rent policies under the MTW authority. So the public process is similar to the MTW plan and to other changes to the ACOP that we've done in the past. We opened the public comment period on August 8th. The public hearing is today. And then the public comment period will close on September 10th. And hopefully we'll bring the item back to the Board of Commissioners on September 22nd for approval, and then it will be submitted to HUD. Because this is considered a significant change to our ACOP, it's one that required a public comment process and also then must be approved by HUD. So we'll submit it to HUD, and I'm not sure if they will turn it around quickly, but what I do know is that many housing authorities are trying to figure out how to implement this policy as quickly as possible without burdening the tenants that that may have these significant and dramatic rent increases. And so hopefully HUD will work with us to be able to implement the policy. But at this point, once we submit it on after the 22nd, then it will be up to HUD to approve it before we would implement it. And the expectation is that we would implement by November 1st. So I think that's it. If there are any questions, I'm happy to answer them.
No, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you for this. As I was reading through this regarding the public outreach, did you get any comments from residents, from the community?
We have not gotten any public comments so far. We have had some residents call based on the public notice that was in the paper, call and ask questions about it. Those residents actually were on Section 8. So, you know, we let them know that it doesn't impact them. But no public comment from any of the residents or any of the public agencies or community organizations that we sent it to.
Were the 44 families notified?
Yes. So the 44 families received a letter from the executive director explaining not only what the policy says, also explaining how the policy will impact them, how this change will impact them, and notifying them of this public hearing as well. So we sent those notices out at the beginning of the public comment period just to make sure that they had plenty of time to understand, and they were encouraged to talk to their property manager, their property administrator, if they had questions.
And also put any comments in writing before the date.
Right.
Okay. Well, I appreciate your presentation. It's pretty clear.
Yes.
And I think it really gives the families or the affected tenants a number of options, which mm-hmm. is great.
Yes.
There was something about if there's a mixed household, if there are some non-citizens or who are not here legally, mm-hmm. how has that worked under this policy? Are the ones who are not here legally, do they have to pay the full flat rent prorated?
There's a proration right. amount, and I actually don't know off the top of my head how this change will impact them. I know where we are now is you take the flat rent and we can't provide federal housing assistance for people who mm-hmm. are not here with their papers in order. So what there's a proration. We have a few families. We don't have an enormous number of families, either on the Section 8 program or the public housing. Most people have got it resolved, and I came from a jurisdiction prior that we had a huge number of the households that had prorated rent. That's not true here. But what we have to do is factor out the federal subsidy on their portion so their rent is more because we can't. And I'm not, I can look at that when we come back next month. Maybe I can give you a better explanation because I have a few questions about how it's done. I don't know that any of us off the top of our head could probably answer.
Oh. I think your response gives me a pretty good idea. Okay. So thank you.
So I do want to say that the letter to everyone really encouraged them to provide a public comment. I think it's very important because it's a public hearing. I'm not going to opine, but I probably will next month prior to your passage of this and explain my concerns. So the record includes them.
Yeah, I need just a little bit more information. Flat rent versus income-based rent.
So the income-based rent is based on 30% of the adjusted income. The flat rent is a flat rent that the household is offered. So the rent is the same no matter what the income. Whether there's an increase or decrease in the income, the rent will always stay the same unless the family says that there's a financial hardship and then they would come in and have their rent reviewed and go back on the income-based. So typically most households, in fact, about 1,500 of the households that are being served through the public housing program on the income-based model. But there are some households that are working and that may want to, as a means of being self-sufficient, saving some income, they may find that their tenant portion is higher than what the monthly flat rent would be. And so they would select that flat rent, save or do whatever they would choose, I guess, with that difference. And we really encourage a lot of the families that are able to select the flat rent because what we found, at least in the old model, is that it can encourage self-sufficiency and help those families that want kind of a stable rent amount that they know and they pay regularly. And really, I think what we find in the 26 households that are in the family sites is that they're working families that have a relatively higher income, and the same actually in the senior households too. They have higher incomes, and that's why they're selecting the flat rent. Okay.
So, and just one more question.
Sure.
At 80%, when you reach the level of where these households should be, will that be the ceiling? Mm-hmm. I'm asking you.
Right.
Can they, increase it again?
So the flat rents, we were required to increase the flat rents every year under this policy. Like I said, we can develop an MTW activity that would provide a waiver from that policy, but we are required through this new change to review the flat rents every year, and if there is an increase, then we have to make sure that the 80% minimum is met. We're not required to increase them any higher than that.
Okay.
And we are also not required to decrease the flat rents if they are falling below that 80%. So essentially, we review them every year. We would change them as needed to just make sure that they met that 80% level. And the households that are currently on flat rent who are using this three-year kind of phased increase, they would, once they meet the 80% level, then their rents would increase along with everyone else's at the same rate. So if in 2015, well, they just released the 2015 numbers, but 2015 or 2016, if the rents go higher, then presumably those households, all flat rent households, should be paying the same thing after this three-year phase-in period.
They can go up every year if HUD increases mm-hmm. the FMRs.
Yeah, that's what I was
thinking. And interesting on the notice and the rule is that if the FMRs go below, don't go up, we don't have to.
Right.
If the rents go down, we don't have to pass that savings on to our tenants.
Okay.
Which I find devious at best, but it's a public hearing in a minute, so I'm not going to comment on any of this. But yes, they will go up if rents go up, and presuming rents will go up in the Bay Area, they probably will go up every year.
Yeah, extremely high. Okay, thank you.
All right.
Commissioner May.
So we need to just open and close the public hearing?
I have a quick question. Mm-hmm. I appreciate the presentation. It's very good. I had a question on what you just finished talking about was the phasing in.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. On the non-mods, for the 0 to 3 and the 4 to 5 bedrooms, the first year says 15%. The second year is 25%. That's already 40. How do they get to 25 or 35? They go down?
This is saying how much each year, percentage-wise, you can raise it. And the way HUD's notice came out is that everyone has to be at the new flat, the new ceiling rent, the new FMR, within 3 years. But they decided, even though they said you could raise it up to 35%, that there was leeway in how much you could raise each year. So what we did was an analysis of those two groups to figure out what was the least amount we could raise, you know, to have everybody reach the goal. So it turned out for the modernized unit, it was 10% in year one, but it took a 15% increase for the non-mods to reach the full amount by the end of the 3 years. So that's what drove those percentage choices.
I'm assuming the full amount is 35%?
No, it's greater than 35%. It can't be more than 35% each year, is HUD's regulation. We could do 35, 35, and 35 to get the rent. And what we've done is phased it in a lot slower to try and lessen the burden. We've given the smallest one we could build into the first year, in the first year, so that we can have some time to consider if we want to do any MTW activities this spring to put in our plan.
Excellent clarification. Okay, because I'm looking at that end and I'm saying, wait a minute, they're only going up to 35? Because it says up to 35.
Yeah, that's the moment, yeah. That'll take everyone to the full amount.
Okay.
Wonderful. It's just the balance.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, you have to formally open the hearing and close the
hearing. Yeah, well, I have a question first. So just to make sure that I understand, so the universe of families affected by this right now appears to be 44 families.
Right.
Is that correct?
Right, yes.
Okay, and then I think Moses just answered one of my questions here, because I'm looking at this as well, saying, well, is this a worst-case scenario? You could get a 35% increase over 3 years. But what we're really saying is that the worst-case scenario is 35% in any given year.
Mm-hmm.
But right. We have scaled that back to say that in year one, worst-case scenario, and just to see if I understand this right, will be a 10% increase or 15%. Is that right?
Right.
Yeah.
And then year two will be between 10 and 35, depending on
exactly
what you're in. Okay. And then year three up 35.
Right.
And this will take all of the 40-some-odd families up to the new flat rent over 3 years.
Right.
Pushing as much as we can the bulk to the last year.
Okay. Cool. So now my final question is, what is the worst case family scenario in reality? Like, I mean, have we looked at this to see, because people that have different incomes and whatever, I mean, some of these rent changes that they had, I mean, these were some monstrous changes. Just if I remember the numbers, it looked like 60% increases in
right.
rent.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because if you're going from, let's see, if you're going from a three bedroom from 1,100 to almost 1,800, that's a big percentage increase.
Yep.
When was the last time we did this?
President, I think we increased the ceiling, the flat rents in 2007. Is that what we found out?
Around then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we're doing a 7-year catch-up now.
No, that isn't really true. We would not. There's debates about whether or not HUD fair market rent, as they're defining it, applies, this amount applies to our properties without an adjustment. Because they use a fair market rent in a larger area. There are certain adjustment factors in our changes that we can consider in setting the rents that are detailed in the language. And one of the arguments that's going back and forth between agencies and HUD is are our three bedrooms at a market rate, 80% of the market rate, is that really 1,700 or is that closer to 1,400? The amount that HUD's requiring us to raise is under some dispute with the agencies and HUD.
So that is being investigated now?
Well, or complaints are going back and forth. Mm-hmm. We have drafted language in our proposal. Is that where you pulled up the conditions in which we can set the rents? If you look at the draft language on
I think it's the last page.
Yeah, on this second to last page, actually, yeah, where it says, such a reasonable method may consider location, quality, unit size, unit type, age of properties, amenity at the property and an immediate neighborhood, housing services provided, maintenance provided by OHA, and utilities provided by OHA. What we're doing is saying that we need to do our own assessment like we do on the Section 8 program to determine in that geographic area, in that sort of micro rental market, what is the real market rent.
I see. So we may execute from OHA some kind of pushback on these rents. Is that
That's fair
what
to say
we're saying?
That we will make an effort to do that, yes.
Yeah, that I mean, if
we
if,
want it to be as accurate as possible and still conform to the regulation, yes.
Yeah, so in other words, if we look at this and we say these three bedrooms here in East Oakland are just not at that's just not right.
Right.
Yeah, we'll look at, and we want to look at those different areas, and we said not limited to, but those are some of the areas we're going to consider, and we put that in there purposefully for what you're saying. We want to make sure that for that local rental market in any given area, if you take, you know, that sort of, if you take Peralta or Campbell in those areas, and for our housing stock, is it being adjusted correctly for 80% of AMR? I don't want to overshoot it because they're using the larger area.
Okay, right.
And by the larger area, I think it's right. Actually San Francisco, Oakland, I'm not sure, mm-hmm. metropolitan area. So it can be quite exaggerated, I think.
Now do we know what the actual, now I understand that residents have some options. I mean, they mm-hmm. can go to the income base if they, you know, but what is the actual worst case scenario for some of these people?
Well, that's a really valid question because it's where it gets to the core of whether or not this was a smart policy on behalf of HUD who decided to put it in appropriations and get approval to do so. What they're really doing, and although we may only have 44 families that are currently impacted, other agencies have much larger percentages, but that's individual on the agency. But what you're really doing is take part of the reason we only have 44 is because we have a very small public housing stock now.
Right.
And what you're doing is telling those 44 families who can probably find cheaper housing than the rent you're looking at in the post-flat rent list elsewhere within a couple blocks of where they're living now, that they will vacate our property, we'll have to flip units and the cost of the rehab, and we'll have those properties be vacant. And those families will, in many ways, probably be living in less healthy conditions than they're living in now. And lastly, what I really get kind of opposed to this effort is you're taking earned income out of a community. And the earned income is interesting in two ways. One is it's a good example for folks, but secondly, people tend to find jobs if they say, if you're at Lockwood and several of our residents work at Southwest, and they say, oh, there's a job in Southwest, here's where you go apply to someone in the neighborhood, they're more likely to go apply. Those sort of informal networks are the majority, are one of the first ways people actually find meaningful work is when they learn about it from people who live in the neighborhood. So when you say you're going to take a community the size of Lockwood with or Peralta, and you're going to take the people with the most earned income and say, we're going to charge you so much that it really doesn't not worth your while to live here, you can go find something cheaper somewhere else, you're really asking them to move. When you ask them to move, you're removing the network that their neighbors may have to help find resources, including meaningful work. So that's my synopsis of why I'm concerned about the policy from the word go, and why I think we need to look at different ways. If part of our MTW initiative is that we're supposed to be encouraging employment, I don't think that should be married with encouraging you move out.
Right. So then if I understand what you're saying correctly here, I'm just testing my understanding again, is that some of these rents are now assessed at a level which is sufficiently outside of the actual prevailing rent base that, I mean, in other words, our public housing apartments are going to be more expensive than the apartment next door that's not public housing. Is that what you're saying?
That's what I'm that's basically what I'm saying. The reason I'm saying that is, I mean, if HUD wanted to in turn say that we're going to give you full subsidy up to these levels for your units rather than the $475 that they're giving us, I could get behind this. I could help find ways and make it work. If they're saying this is what the rent really is, my question to them is, why aren't they paying us that amount to rent the properties? And they're not. They're paying us $400. And what I'm telling you is that if you're a three-bedroom family in Peralta and you're living in Peralta and you're happy there, you can probably go find an apartment very nearby that isn't $1,763.
Well, then that means that
whether it's still at 80% AMI or not isn't really what I'm talking about. I'm just talking about the competitiveness of a family trying to not pay a lot of rent.
So we're really saying that the evidence we have is that these rents that we are calculating based on the HUD directive are inaccurate.
No, I'm saying that the rental market around
they're too high.
Well, and I'm saying high. And I'm saying that people in these units paying this amount of rent for our units can probably find more affordable places to live.
Yeah, okay, got it. Now, so the final question, is, I'm just very interested in the worst case scenario. So there might be one or five families, right, that are going to be really negatively impacted by this. I would like to know how negative that impact is, because even if it's one family, if you're that one family, that is really going to be a bummer. So I just want to make sure that we're, you know, protecting everybody, that, you know, I mean, we're looking at all of our residents. And just at least, I mean, not that we can necessarily do anything about it, but we just want to make sure we know so we can at least try. Advise. Yeah, right, exactly. So we can advise them or do something just so that we know what they're going to be facing.
We do know that there's either the flat rent and there will be a difference between what their current rent is in the year one, two, and three amounts, or the income-based rent that they would be required to pay. And we know that amount. And so because there's a choice between flat rent or income-based, I could probably provide some of the data for the 44 households to see what that difference is that they'll expect. Either they'll pay income-based, which would be a certain amount, or...
Yeah, right. It's going to depend on what their income is.
Exactly, exactly.
And we've done the analysis for the 44. Some of that chart was in last month's
right.
In the packet, and without the names, because we have to redact everything. Yeah. But it gives you some of the idea, and it's large enough for a chunk of the 44 that they will, I think, choose to move. So it's just a question of if they really get into the
yeah.
full amount.
Yeah. Okay.
Exactly.
Okay. Okay, thank you. No, I'm done. No, we can take more.
And that's, and by the way, I think that's the intent of HUD, that they move.
They move.
Yeah.
Wow.
Just one thought.
That's scary.
So they have no other subsidies.
Yeah, they're on they're on the public housing subsidy, so we only get the operating subsidy and the tenant portion of rent. Someone in D.C. decided there was a lot of money if they did this that we could be collecting from tenants. And that would lessen the burden of the operating subsidy, because remember, they're combined. If we take a dollar of tenants' rents, we get a dollar less from HUD. So HUD, in their analysis, figured that if everybody went to 80% AMI, there would be all this additional tenant revenue that we'd be collecting that they wouldn't have to pay then operating subsidy to agencies. And they didn't listen to the concerns that were voiced that said, you're really just going to have people move out, and you're really just going to have people move in with lower rent, and, you know, with a lower calculation, and you're probably going to end up paying us more subsidy. And we're going to have the burden of having a vacant unit, and we're going to lose some of our longest-term residents.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Question.
Yeah, and this is just a clarification question. I'm looking at 16.2B. It says the new flat rent will also be offered to existing residents at their next recertification, and will be effective following HUD approval. And so help me understand that.
Okay, so the flat rent option is offered to tenants at their recertification. Mm-hmm. It's also offered for tenants that are on the triennial schedule. It's offered every year as well, just to make sure that they are not it's not a full re-exam, but it is an offer of the switch between income-based or flat rent. And so what this is saying is that this policy will be implemented upon HUD approval. So HUD has to approve it first, then we'll make the change reflected in the ACOP. And then those families that are not on the flat rent currently will be offered the flat rent at their next re-examination. The families that are currently on the flat rent will be offered the new, will be, their phase-in process will start at their reexamination as well.
So it doesn't take effect the minute we pass it.
Okay.
It first has to go through HUD approval, otherwise okay. we can't do it. And then after it gets HUD approval, then it would only take effect for that family. If their annual recertifications in next September, they'll come in next September, and that's when they would have the first increase in the tax.
And the new schedule of flat rents, which is included in the lease, will be included in the lease upon HUD approval after November 1st. So for households that are not currently on flat rent, the only flat rent that they will be offered after HUD approves it and after you all approve it would be the one that's set at the 80% minimum.
And that's for all new emissions.
Too. Right, and new emissions as well, yeah.
Okay, I'm clear now, thank you.
Okay, so, Commissioner Lee.
Sorry.
I'm just a little confused.
Sorry, uh-huh.
For new tenants who may elect flat rent, will that be at the full 80%? Or is that at the current flat rent plus the 10%?
So there's no phase-in for new admissions after it passes.
Right.
It just becomes the new flat rent. We don't really admit people in that with that income. So it's not. But usually the people who are paying flat rent have been with us for a very long time and had a progression up to the ceiling rent or the flat rent. And there are two phrases. The old one was ceiling rent, and now it's a flat rent. They changed the rules. This takes immediate effect in terms of any new admissions and changes the currently impacted families, those 44, those are the ones that we phase it in.
Yeah.
All right.
Thank you.
Wow. Okay. I guess there is no more questions.
Can I have
Yes.
Just one more. Explain a little bit about why the 44 families now.
Why
the 44, the ones that's
they're
chosen.
They're between the current flat rent and the new flat rent. So they're already on flat rent. They're not an income-based. So, and the way it generally works, if you choose income-based, their rents are, people on income-based are all below the flat rent because they pay less rent. And then if your income says you're gonna be higher than the flat rent, then you would choose flat rent and your rent would be frozen at this amount rather than if it was just 30%, it would be higher. So those are the households we're talking about, the people who are on the flat rent that they're away from the wage calculation because their wages are such that they would pay more rent if they went on the wage calculation. And this is just gonna move them into the wage calculation or up to the full flat rent. I think the majority of people don't reach the full flat rent. I don't remember the exact percentage.
Right, I think, sorry.
Excuse me, I think in year one we had a projection that about 32 people would elect to keep the flat rent level, 32 of that 44. Then it decreases significantly to about 15 for year two, and then for year three, only 6 households would have an income-based rent that is higher than the flat rent. And so that's if the rent levels stay where they are today. And because we know that, you know, each year the rents will go up, those families probably, it will be more likely that there will be more families that select the income-based or as the executive director said, choose other somewhere else to live.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Good. Well, I'd like to thank you for a very articulate and well presented effort here, and I just as I go back to the last question that I had, another way of looking at that worst case scenario would be to just simply calculate a worst case scenario, whether any of our residents are that or not, so that we just at least know how bad this could get. And then we can compare that to our residents and we could kind of get some idea at least of who might be, you know, reasonably close to that. Because I just am curious as to what could be the worst case scenario here. If someone just happens to have the wrong income, be living in the wrong place and the wrong everything else, and just what might happen to them. So anyway, thank you. Thank you very much.
So there are no speakers on that item.
So now we're going to.
So we don't need to open and close public comment, Jennifer?
We don't.
It's done? Okay. Council says we have opened and closed the public comment period. by having the item.
Wow.
Not the public comment period, the public hearing.
The public hearing, sorry.
We don't need all the
Okay.
Oh, we have opened and closed.
We don't need to state it for the record. We have no speakers on the item. And
we have opened and closed the public
hearing.
Hearing. So now we are opening nothing.
That's it.
We're done.
Yeah, you're done.
We're now moving on. So we're now moving on to item C.
Item C is consideration of a resolution authorizing the executive director to exercise 2 one-year option terms to renew the contract with Automatic Data Processing, or ADP, and increase the contract amount by $145,000 for each additional option term for integrated human resources, payroll, timekeeping, tax, pension, and welfare reporting system. This is a contract that we approved 3 years ago. The price has actually gone up just once during the terms of our contract, and that was this spring. This is adding the 2 option terms for the next 2 years. The increase in price is really related to an increase of frequency of payroll, because we're doing payroll once a week for our force account, which has increased it. But we've also added some of the functions, and Janet is not here, but Craig is here if we have any questions or you'd like to discuss it.
I'll move the item.
Second.
Moved and seconded. All those in favor?
Aye.
All those opposed? Abstentions? It's unanimous. So now moving on to item D, I have no speaker cards.
There are none.
And there are no speaker cards. So that means we are now moving on to written communications.
Written communications includes the monthly report and walking through a couple of the other written communications I put in the packet. One is the approval for the Oakland Housing Authority's fiscal year 2015 annual moving to work plan. I'm pleased that we have the approval. I would also like to just congratulate everyone who worked on it, particularly Dominica, for pulling this out, getting the approval done. We are among a few people in the country who have their approval letters, I would tell you, and other people are having challenges because of some issues with HUD. And Dominica sailed us through those waters very rapidly and got the approval out, and I'm grateful for
excellent
it.
Excellent work.
The other one is a letter that is actually related to CAHI, but I wanted to include it in our board report because of their affiliation with OHA and kind of update you on some of the efforts that are going on in that. Several years ago, the CAHI board authorized us filing a lawsuit against HUD related to how they bid their contract, and that has been going on since 2011 is, I think, when we filed. It's been a long, long road. This letter was written, as you can see, first to Jillian Castro, the new secretary, and then Carrie Hickman, who is in the program, from a group of folks administering the program, including us, asking to restore Moores. But what I really wanted to do is give you an update. Since then, we have on appeal, we have one appeal, the appeal at this point. It's gone through, we've won the entire end of the case. They have one thing that they can do left. They went to try and go back and have it be, what's it called, the whole bench?
En banc,
where all of the justices would review the case, and they refused to hear it, and we won that. Jennifer's been instrumental in tying this together with another action against a letter that was filed with HUD that we're contesting on the CAHI side as well. But I'm pleased that we have won that. That en banc was denied, and that the only step left for HUD is to go to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court agree to hear it. And I'm highly unlikely that either of those things would occur. So it looks like we're in the end of the road with that, and it looks like HUD is going to have to conduct a procurement based on the FAR, which is the Federal Acquisition Regulations, I think is what it stands for, FAR, which is what we've been advocating and suing about since 2011 after 2 procurements. CAHI will be able to bid on those should they open it up. We don't know the status of what that will be. Our current contract for that work expires December 31st, and it can be extended, and I would expect at least a year, if not longer, to be offered us. And I'll inform you as we get closer to December, but I wanted to update the full board, although two of your members sit on the CAHI board, so you'd be aware of where we are with HUD. Certainly they're not happy that they lost this and have fought it very tenaciously, but we are grateful for the understanding of the judicial system in hearing our case and bringing some sanity into the issue. And it wasn't just us, and you can see with these letters, what we're trying to do is restore management and occupancy reviews, which was work they took away from us a couple of years ago. If they restore that and they have the authority to do it, it would return CAHI into doing that additional work, which we would make a fee for. So we're fighting that fight and with them, because I think we're going to probably have the contract for another year or two. And HUD really should be doing those MOR reviews, at least in a triage manner. If they're not doing, going to do 100%, they can do properties at risk that they identify through other indicators. So moving on, we have a BALCES Resident Services report from Lion Creek Crossing, which is always terrific and nice to read. And we have then the calendar and the upcoming conferences. So that's all my written materials. If you have any questions, then I'll move on to a couple of comments. I'm going to be brief. Seems like sometimes I have a list, but the first thing I want to do is thank our staff for making it through another successful summer, and that's all of the staff, family, community partnerships, OHAPD, property management, all do more during the summer than I think is ever called for. We have a lot of field trips, a lot of activities, and we had Lockwood Gardens had their going back to school party on Friday, and at Cole School we had one with OUSD and back to school on Thursday, and on Wednesday we had the backpack giveaway. And then Lanita also organized the Call All Our Families list again this year. So we did get reminder calls last week to our families. And it's all extra, a whole lot of extra work for people all summer. And I'm always very grateful for the work that they do. And it really does make a difference. In our summer youth employment effort, I think we have, I don't think we're at 300 last I saw the count. But they haven't finished, I think, doing all the certifications is my guess. Yeah. And hopefully we'll hit 300, but you know, we're right in the sweet spot for how many residents we can find. So last year we ended up at 292 and then 4, I think, at the end, something like that. So we're doing well with that. And you know, from my perspective, I think it's probably been the quietest summer I remember being here in terms of incidents that have gone out in the community. And I think it's a combination of the efforts I just said, along with some real community policing and different and changes within the city, but particularly I think a lot of our efforts within our neighborhoods. It's been a nice, now that it's Monday and kids are back to school, I can say it's the quietest summer I remember in seven summers. And I just want to thank all of you for helping making that happen, the staff and the board, because I think that that's the result of the decisions the board made and the endless work that staff does to try and build community trust and provide employment opportunities and activities for our youth. And it's a long road, but I think we've made progress, and I'm grateful. I also wanted to give you an update on the MTW extension negotiations. There is, so I am on the small negotiating committee, and along with Andrew Lofton in Seattle are actually the two leads on the negotiations with HUD on our extension. We have participating with us are Cambridge, Keene County, which Keene, K-E-E-N, which is a small county in Vermont, and Josh Meehan, great guy, Paul Graziano from Baltimore, and Rick Gentry from San Diego are the folks who are negotiating it. It's already time consuming, and we've only started a week ago. It started with really a letter that I provided you last spring. They wanted an amendment. Of course, I'm convinced that if people didn't create issues, they wouldn't have jobs in D.C. So we're working through those issues. One of them is they've identified there are 11 older MTW agencies, of which we're one, and they want to have a language change to the way they do public housing operating subsidy. We have a frozen base. This all gets really technical, but we are also impacted. We've done our analysis with Tracy and her staff, and we think it's about $700,000 a year, $788,000 to be a little closer, which is phenomenal to me that. And we may be wrong about the figure that we went over this afternoon. Because we have a frozen base, we haven't been doing it quite the way that the rest of them are doing it. But there's a big loss, according to HUD. HUD maintains that they overpay subsidy by $200 million throughout those agencies. And some of those agencies are extremely large on the public housing side, including Chicago. So it's going to be a rough discussion. On that issue. The other issue has to do with exceeding the 90% utilization rate, which some agencies in the 39 have challenges with. We do not, as you know, and we're working back up to 100% again, and maintaining that. And there's a proposal by HUD to re-benchmark in 2018, meaning kind of flip out how many people are utilized and do a re-benchmarking in 2018 for 2019. They're putting it off, which is good. And if we know what they mean clearly, then we can prepare for it. And those are kind of the challenges we have in terms of the extension. But I have faith that if I can keep everyone from getting angry, that we might actually get a lot of the deals off the table. I haven't been in this kind of negotiating environment. It reminds me when I negotiated on behalf of AFSCME, and they had all these folks behind me, and then there were like three of us on the team, and we had to deal with this, and then we had to deal with that. But they're a good group, and I think people understand that we want to get as close to a deal as we possibly can, and hopefully a whole deal. But to get people moving forward is going to be really time-consuming. I just want the board aware that I'm very distracted, but I think it's in the best interest of this agency to get this deal in place by December. Dominic Bloom is the lead on the HUD side. She's in special applications, MTW, and a couple other things. And she has support from a few of the HUD staff over there, including HUD General Counsel, and who wants to review things. She is committed, as I would tell you I am, to be pretty much at a deal by December. And if there's something that we can't agree on, then let's say we can't agree and we'll go fight our fight elsewhere. That's it, other than say we have started our 2014 audit. I met with them this afternoon. I think we have some other meetings scheduled, but they are going to be on site in a couple weeks with the list and get started. We're trying to get it done a little sooner again this year, so hopefully we can get it in the early December. But last year was heroic in getting it done by December 31st and getting our CAFER. And she was very proud that we got the CAFER award, I would say, when I met with her today. And that's it. I'm available for any questions.
Very good. Okay, so now, do we have any reports from commission committees?
You know, I know we haven't. Have we scheduled the education committee yet?
We haven't. We'll get some emails out. We can, maybe Inez and Lanita can work on that tomorrow.
Okay. All right, so now, do we have any announcements by commissioners?
Well, you know, yeah, go ahead.
Commissioner Montgomery.
No, I just wanted to thank in the report about them committed to partnership meeting the new superintendent. I would like to applaud them for working with him because he's supposed to be making great changes for the Oakland Unified School District. So just want to commend them on participating in that meeting, and we'll get a little feedback later as to what they think about it.
Yeah, I've met with him his second day here, which I was very pleased. He called and said, I'm starting early and are you available Tuesday? And he met with the chief and I, and we have our lieutenant is over there as the chief, and we discussed that a little bit. And I was in another meeting with Urban Strategies, just talking about some of the core issues at OUSD with some other partners. And I think he brings a new discipline and energy to the district, and I'm excited to see how the year prevails. One thing I have learned about education, and I think the committee can attest to this, everything works in annual cycles. And so this first year, he can't have quite the impact that he's going to be able to have in his second year. And I think people need to be given a good chance because it's a challenging world.
And I think everybody's excited that has met him that he'll bring some changes. Thank you.
Okay, I'm finished.
Okay.
I can just... If the staff and if you guys can just bear with me for a minute, I just wanted to, a lot goes into the report and I take the time to read it and I just want to make some comments. So forgive me, but we are doing phenomenal work. As I was reading about the grant that we applied for PG&E, thank you. Lanita, did you do that? The $20,000, PG&E, thank you for doing that. When will we know if we get it? When will we know? Do you know?
When will you know if we get it?
It's for the urban file. Soon. Okay, thank you for doing that. The other thing I was really pleased to see is home ownership, what's happening in that area. Thank you again for that. At the Boys and Girls Club, thank you. Great work there. Hold on, just okay. And I had something else I wanted to say. The meetings that you guys attended, Oakland Unified School District, the meetings that were attended with OUSD. This is what's in the packet here.
Yeah, do you have what page?
Oh, God, I have my flag on here. What was that?
OUSD Partnership, page 4,
yeah,
halfway down?
Yeah, page 4, right.
Yeah, so they're attending the quarterly Oakland Education Cabinet at Mills.
Okay, that was really good. Good to be reading that. And the final thing I want to say is the new funding for violence prevention, Geyser. I was really pleased to see that. Geyser Foundation violence prevention mini grant that we got. I was really pleased in reading that too. So I wanted to make note of that. That's a big serious issue in our communities, violence prevention, and anything that we can do in that area is a plus. Yeah, that's it. And then I got a couple more, just real quick, a couple more, just want to know what we've been doing at the neuro level. I want to thank the authority for allowing me to represent you at the national level on the International Committee. At our meeting on August the 8th, the International Committee is going to be taking the international level to the chapter in the region. I want you to realize the significance in the International Committee work. And Moses, I want you to hear that. They're bringing it down to the region and chapter levels, in case I want you to know that. And then at our meeting on the 8th, they talked about attendance at the national conferences. And I think you mentioned this at the last meeting, Moses, that if you missed two meetings, two conferences, you're off the committee. And I've only missed one because I didn't go to the summer, but I will be at the national. And again, thank you for allowing me to represent you at the national level. Okay.
Okay, is that? Is that it?
That's it. Yeah.
Oh,
thank
okay,
you, Director.
Good.
Thank you, Chair. Hartwood, thank you, sir.
Yeah. I just wanted to make a quick comment regarding CAHI. CAHI is really important to the mission of OHA. And so I just want to point out that this good stuff that happened with CAHI, the reason that this happened is because our senior management here was on the ball and really chose to do something and take this on and take action here. And I'd also like to pass on thanks to our legal department because they did a great job here with this stuff to make this all happen. So thanks a lot, and I guess it's now time to go home. So we have a motion for adjournment. So moved, so done.
Second.
Thank you.
Cool, baby. All right.